content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine.
Friend, the message included screenshots of Facebook posts as evidence, and this message: don't do anything rash. We need a game plan. That night we sat around our kitchen table rehashing what happened. There was a lot of how did he and how could he and why would he. She and I could have sat there till sunup asking questions we had no answers to. Instead, we hatched up ways I could respond. There was always blackmail. It's a little cliched, but it would be torture for him and lucrative for me. Plus, I could get creative with my demands, treat it like a healthy outlet for anger and sadness. I could fly to the city where he lives, knock on his door, and deliver a hard slap to his handsome jaw, but the logistics were too precarious and expensive to add up. Or I could try the opposite of face-to-face, the very popular yet cowardly online shaming. None of these options were right, because this mess wasn't about just him and me. He had a wife. I'd never met this woman, but I didn't want to hurt her any more than I knew he was about to hurt her. I pictured her sitting on a wheat-colored couch in their living room, her feet propped on the coffee table, oblivious and still whole. I worried she wouldn't believe me if I contacted her, that she would hate me, that I would ruin her life, but I also knew it was the only right thing to do. The next morning, I hit compose on an email. I had found her address online, and typed a subject line, "I'm sorry to have to send this." Since December 2018, I have been in a serious, long-distance relationship. He told me that you and he divorced. I have not communicated with him. If you are indeed married to him, you are the person who has the right to confront him. Please know that I never, ever once thought my relationship with him could hurt you or anyone. Sincerely, Casey. She replied quickly, and we scheduled a call. I had 50 minutes to prepare for the impending, awful conversation I'd set in motion. I tried to put myself in this woman's shoes, to think about what I should and shouldn't say on this call with my ex-boyfriend's wife of 15-plus years. What would be useful for her? How could I prevent further harm? And how the hell did I get here? What kind of woman allows herself to get into a situation where she's preparing to call her ex-boyfriend's wife to tell her about the 3-year affair he's been having? I dialed the number she gave me. Hello? Hi, this is Casey. Thank you for calling me. I'm not sure what to say. Her voice was deeper, softer than I had expected. Of course, I'm so sorry. She asked when and where her husband and I saw each other. I told her we met up every few weeks, most often in Indiana at my house. It was easier for him to travel since I have school-aged children. Yes, he knew my children. He'd met my parents. We were making plans for him to move here. He'd picked out a fourth-floor apartment with great natural light. But there was no signed lease or giant metal storage container full of my boyfriend's belongings sitting in his front yard, her front yard, ready to be picked up and trucked across 4 states. He had told his wife that the company he worked for had investors in Indiana, which was why he traveled there all the time. No, there are no investors here, I told her. We agreed we felt like the idiotic female characters in some vulgar, low-budget movie, the kind that as you watch it, you're throwing your hands up and yelling at the TV, begging the women to notice the damned red flags. And we didn't want to be in a movie like that. What we both wanted were love and trust, and we both thought we were getting it from the same man. After almost an hour on the phone, we still didn't know how and why he did what he did, but we were worn out. We agreed we'd talk again soon. In the meantime, she was going home to confront her husband, pack a bag, and get the next flight back home to Texas, for good. We emailed a few times over the next couple of days. Her parents warned her to be careful. She wasn't sure she should trust me, and I was desperate for the connection. The writing, reading, and sharing were therapeutic. We compared notes about his supposed work trips and family health emergencies to see how he fit into the stories he told us. Uncovering these bits of truth felt a little like retribution. Our strange, intimately shared experience of being loved and deceived by the same man has spawned a friendship of sorts, one with zero judgment. While other people might hear our stories and think we're crazy for not noticing any obvious signs over the course of 3 years, We know firsthand how it can happen to perfectly sane women. Now we're getting through it together. My own vivid dreams of a future with this man were torched as soon as I learned he was married. The person I loved never existed. He made it all up so there was no one to miss or mourn. But because I believed his whole act, I don't trust myself anymore. I also feel for her. Through the years, her identity and self-worth were wrapped up in who they were as a couple. While he was the charismatic charmer, from what I could tell, she was the compassionate one. She emailed me once that she felt a little sad for him, that we were talking, and now he's got neither of us. It seems sort of tragic, and my heart goes out to him about that. She is discovering who she is on her own. When I wrote to her that I was afraid my teenage sons would see me as the other woman and a villain when I eventually told them the truth about why we broke up, she gave me the words to use. She said to tell them, "You made it my choice to confront him. You tell them that you made my life better." It was the most generous email I could receive. 7 months after our first contact, we're making plans to meet in person. Our next article by Mary Grace Taylor is titled, 10 Brain Healthy Foods to Work into Your Everyday Diet. Here's some food for thought. What you eat can keep your brain in better health for the long term. Research shows that eating a wholesome, nutrient-dense diet, such as the MIND diet, may significantly slow age-related cognitive decline and slash your risk for diseases such as Alzheimer's. It might even change the structure of your noggin to support cognitive skills like memory and attention, found a study published earlier this year in Scientific Reports. So which foods exactly are the best for your brain? There's evidence that it's not all about just one food for brain health, but how combinations of food work together, says Mark Milstein, PhD, author of The Age-Proof Brain. Dietary patterns rich in fruits, veggies, fish, and fiber-rich foods like beans and whole grains seem to be the most beneficial. If you're looking for some specific items to add to your shopping list, these foods are a great place to start. Leafy greens. Here's one more reason to go green. Eating just one daily serving of leafy vegetables, think half a cup of cooked greens or a cup of raw ones, can keep you sharper longer, found one neurology study. Veggies like spinach, kale, collard greens, and lettuce are rich in phytochemicals like folate, vitamin K, and lutein, which are thought to slow the rate of age-related cognitive decline. Make it a routine that you make or order a salad daily, and you'll hit the mark, says Wendy Bazillion, Dr. Ph., author of the Eat Clean, Stay Lean series. Or try tossing a handful of greens into a smoothie, adding sautéed greens to grain bowls, or on top of whole wheat pizza, or snacking on do-it-yourself kale chips. Fatty fish. Options like salmon, mackerel, tuna, and herring are some of Milstein's favorite brain-boosting foods. They're rich in omega-3 fatty acids, which form a vital coating for the brain cells to help them send electrical signals. These electrical signals play a crucial role in remembering, thinking, and focusing, Milstein explains. Aim to enjoy at least 2 4-ounce servings of fish per week, recommends the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. The omega-3s found in foods may be more beneficial than those found in supplements like fish oil. Blueberries. The tiny fruits pack a big phytochemical punch. Blueberries are rich in anthocyanins, which deliver neuroprotective benefits by fighting inflammation and oxidation and supporting healthy blood sugar. All of these functions play an important role in maintaining and protecting the health of the brain, as well as help delay or minimize the effects of aging, says Bazillion. Blueberries are also rich in prebiotics, beneficial fibers that feed the good bacteria in your gut. And what's good for the gut is good for the brain, Milstein says, since mounting evidence shows that digestive health influences cognitive function. Avocado. Replacing just half of a daily serving of animal-based foods like butter, cheese, or processed meat with avocado may reduce the risk of heart disease by up to 22%, found a recent American Heart Association study. And that in turn benefits the brain. When your blood vessels and circulatory system are healthy, your brain is better able to receive the blood, oxygen, and nutrients it needs to function at its best, Bazillion explains. Walnuts. Like avocado, nuts are packed with healthy unsaturated fats that support the brain by protecting your heart, and walnuts seem to be particularly powerful. They're rich in nutrients including polyphenols, tocopherols, and polyunsaturated fatty acids like omega-3 fats that may play an important role in supporting brain function and slowing the onset of age-related decline, Bazilian says. Make it a point to enjoy at least 2 1-ounce servings of walnuts per week. Women in their 50s and 60s who consumed that much were significantly less likely to develop chronic diseases or memory impairment after age 65, per one Journal of Aging Research study. Coffee. Your morning brew doesn't just help you feel more focused and alert after sipping. Regular coffee consumption is also tied to lower rates of cognitive decline, according to a 10-year study published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Subjects who drank 3 cups of coffee per day earn the biggest brain benefits, but having more than that isn't necessarily better. Consuming more than 6 cups of coffee per day could actually increase the risk of stroke or dementia, research shows. Broccoli. Leafy greens aren't the only veggies that are good for your gray matter. Cruciferous vegetables like broccoli, along with cauliflower, cabbage, and Brussels sprouts, are loaded with the phytochemical sulforaphane, which may protect against Alzheimer's and neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's, findings suggest. Phytochemicals help protect, repair, neutralize, eliminate, and more, Bazilian explains. Try roasting broccoli with balsamic vinegar or lemon for a side dish or grain bowl topping, or swapping lightly steamed broccoli for basil in your favorite pesto recipe. Oatmeal. Eating at least 3 servings of whole grains like oatmeal per day is tied to slower rates of decline in cognitive function and memory, found a Current Developments in Nutrition study. One possible reason? Whole grains are rich in fiber. A cup of cooked oatmeal has 4 grams, which supports normal cholesterol levels and healthy blood vessel function. When we protect the heart, we protect the brain, Milstein says. Green tea. The jury's still out on whether green tea delivers long-term brain protection, but enjoying the grassy sipper just might help you feel sharper in the moment. Green tea contains caffeine plus phytochemicals, including L-theanine and EGCG, which are thought to work together, improving alertness, focus, and memory, concluded one review. Dark chocolate. Fun fact, places with the highest chocolate consumption just so happen to have the greatest concentration of Nobel Prize winners. While there's no guarantee the sweet stuff will boost your IQ, research does show that dark chocolate is rich in flavanols that may support healthy cognitive function by fighting inflammation. Just stick with chocolate containing at least 60% cacao, since lower percentages may not be enough to offer benefits. About 1 ounce a day could fit into your diet without having to make much adjustment elsewhere, Bazilian says. Our next article by Martha Beck is titled, Do You Need More Fun in Your Life? I am dead serious about fun. As a life coach, I am determined to help all my clients have as much fun as they possibly can. I'm often surprised by how vehemently some of them reject this idea. They see fun as trivial, unworthy, disreputable. Maybe they'll have fun someday, they tell me, but not until they've made a huge fortune or a scientific breakthrough or an artistic masterpiece. What they don't realize is that people who achieve such things are the ones who have fun doing them. Having fun is not a diversion from a successful life, it is the pathway to it. Each of us is born with a propensity to have fun doing certain types of activities in certain proportions. You may love doing something I hate and vice versa. I call the pattern of activities you most enjoy your fun print, and like your thumbprint, it's unique. It seems obvious to me, and research backs me up, that we are most productive, persistent, creative, and flexible when we're engaged in precisely the combination of activities that brings us maximum fun. Your fun print isn't a frivolous indulgence. It is the map of your true life, an instruction manual for your essential purpose, written in the language of joy. Learning to read and respond to it is one of the most crucial things you'll ever do. My views on fun rely on a rather narrow definition of the word. Fun is sometimes used to describe both the best and worst of human behavior. Bullies may torment others for fun. Addicts may have fun that destroys their health and relationship. I'm using quotation marks because these forms of fun aren't really fun. They're faux fun, and they lead straight to misery. It isn't difficult to tell faux and real fun apart once you've learned to recognize the manic giddiness of the former and the nourishing pleasure of the latter. If you're not clear which is which, the following factors can help you spot a fake. Number one, faux fun helps you ignore problems. Real fun helps you face them. In high school, I had a group of talented friends who defined fun as playing fantasy games and smoking pot. The more stress they felt at school, the more they pursued fun that helped them ignore their anxiety and its underlying causes. Another group of friends tackled school stress by scheduling study sessions during which everyone would work in silence for periods of half an hour, with breaks in between spent talking and joking. The companionship of these friends may not sound very hip, but I found it more fun than the thinly veiled distress of my pothead buddies. Number two, faux fun gets boring. Real fun never does. Real sources of fun are what psychologists call renewable pleasures, enjoyable no matter how many times you do them. For example, if you're getting just enough food, eating will be fun for you at every meal. But if you're devouring more than your body needs, you'll need more and more exotic treats to make food interesting. I indulge in this form of faux fun every December without fail. If you have a voracious need for more and more expensive toys, prestigious awards, kinky sex, and so on, the root of your craving probably isn't the sparkle of real fun, but an inner void. Number three, if you're having real fun, you'll never regret it. Guzzling a gallon of tequila may be fun for a while, but eventually it's going to make you feel like hell. The same is true of all faux fun pursuits. You can identify them by their wretched aftermath. The discomforts of alcohol abuse are obvious, but all faux fun creates a hangover. Have you ever had a conversation that seemed enjoyable but left you feeling wary or uneasy? Your instincts are telling you that at least part of the fun was false. I've experienced this after interactions where either I or some other person was dishonest, mean-spirited, or passive. Often I didn't see the problem until a disturbance in the fun force prompted me to identify and change my behavior. Number four, real fun makes everyone feel better. Faux fun makes everyone feel worse. I recently read an interview with a radio shock jock who spends virtually all his on-air time humiliating people. This man is constantly smiling. Are his guests, though many of them later seem traumatized. One committed suicide after appearing on the show. At one point, the reporter asked the shock jock how he was feeling at the moment. "I'm sad," he answered with admirable candor. "I'm always sad." Apparently, this man isn't really making fun at all. He's making sadness, not only for the people he mocks, but for himself. We can't do deliberate harm without damaging our own psyches, especially if we're dysfunctional enough to call it fun. Whenever my clients realize that they're wasting time on faux fun, they always make the same mistake. They try to replace their bad habits with some strenuously virtuous activity, such as exercise, house cleaning, or office overtime. This does not work. The only thing that can successfully replace faux fun is real fun. If you have no idea what you like doing, if you've never had fun in your life, and don't know how to figure out what you enjoy, get help. Total funlessness is as serious as a heart attack and deserves the same kind of respect. Get a medical checkup. The problem may be exhaustion, illness, or chemical imbalance, in which case you need treatment. If you don't, you might have unhealed emotional wounds, such as a trauma or loss you've never processed. A therapist can make worlds of difference, and you should consult one. For less severe cases, the following techniques can reconnect you with your sense of fun. Technique number one, fishing for smiles. Sit down with a notebook and list things you enjoy, anything from picking your teeth to touring Nepal. As you write down each item, seriously consider doing that very thing later today or this week or this year. You'll have different emotional reactions to each idea. We're looking for one in particular, something I call the spontaneous smile. This is a smile that bubbles up almost irrepressibly, like a beach ball popping out of water. You don't feel that you're smiling so much as being smiled. Your whole body may relax. I've seen this happen to people and felt it happen to me while contemplating very small pleasures, say tickling a cat, or a very large one such as getting married. I've learned to trust this response as a powerful clue from the true self, a signal that one's innate sense of fun has been awakened and is pointing the way to a joyful, meaningful life. Technique number two, childhood revisited. Genetic research suggests that our fun preferences are largely inborn and remain consistent throughout life. The time when we're free to act on them is usually childhood, so that's another great place to look for your fun print. In your trusty notebook, begin listing things you remember enjoying as a child. Pay particular attention to things that made you lose time, so that hours seem to disappear in seconds. What absorbed you that completely? Telling stories, climbing trees, playing dress-up? You may want to ask family members whose recollections can jog your memory. Next, look for patterns in this childhood fun. Did you like playing alone or with others? Inside or outside? Calmly or roughly? With words, objects, or actions? Almost certainly, those preferences still exist in you, even after all your years in prep school or prison or wherever. No socialization is so complete that it can override the fun print buried in our genes. Choosing careers, avocations, and personal activities that fit this code will make you happier and more purposeful across the board. Technique number 3, real-time research. This technique requires that you keep a cursory fun journal on a calendar. Every day, jot down a brief list of your major activities. Give each experience a fun score with 0 meaning no fun and 10 meaning funtabulous. As the days go by, you'll begin to see which activities and people yield the most fun, and you'll be surprised. My clients almost always find that the activities they think will be supremely fun, eating dinner at the Ritz, consistently rank lower than things they've been taking for granted, eating Ritz crackers for dinner. Almost all of us can have wonderful fun without nearly as much money, education, beauty, and power as we think we need. These methods are just training wheels designed to get you to the real goal of continuously feeling and responding to your sense of fun. Once you've learned to do that, it's time to align your actual behavior with your fun print. This is as far from trivial and self-indulgent as you can get. It may be the biggest, bravest thing you'll ever do. For example, when my friend Gloria gave up the faux fun of chain smoking, she discovered that her perpetual nicotine high had masked a profound lack of joy in her perfect-looking life. Her funless marriage couldn't stand the strain, and overnight Gloria went from country club socialite to starving student single mother. She enrolled in college. She'd call me every so often to say, "I have no money, no social life, no time to do anything but study. I've never had so much fun in my life." Today, 6 years later, Gloria is taking the board exams to become an MD. Her fun print led her right through med school, and she is following it onward, planning to do volunteer pediatrics in the third world. This isn't the sort of life that pops into our minds when we hear the phrase, "girls just want to have fun," but I think maybe it should. Although most people don't stray as far from their purpose as Gloria did, we all tend to take unexpected and interesting turns when we do what thrills us most. I don't know where your fun print might take you, should you decide to find and follow it, but I am pretty sure that along the way you'll be challenged, scared, stretched to your limits, and gratified almost beyond belief. You'll probably make this world a much, much better place. But we'll never know unless you try. Our next article by Jen A. Miller is titled, "At 40, Daring to Pursue a Childhood Dream of Surfing." Remember joyful childhood days spent flying around on bikes, roller skates, or surfboards, and pounding the pavement during hours of double dutch, basketball, or tennis? This summer, get inspired to get up, get out, and have fun with our series, Move Your Body, in which women share stories of channeling their inner child by diving into an activity they loved or yearned to learn as a kid. Most people learn to surf when they're young and bendy. I did not. I waited until the summer of 2020, 2 months before my 40th birthday, to give the sport a try, when my body was far less able to bounce back on the many occasions when a wave pushed my torso in one direction and pulled a surfboard attached to my leg via a tether in another. Because in that summer of all summers, convenience and distress converged and led me to an 8-foot foam plank in an electric blue, exactly the same shade as my favorite childhood bathing suit. Who cared if I left a little of my dignity in the water every time I paddled out and set myself in the way of a wave? It's not like I had anywhere else to go or anything else to do. Might as well do battle with the ocean before the pandemic swallowed me whole. I dreamed of surfing for as long as I could swim. As a kid, I spent my summers in a campground 5 miles inland from Avalon, New Jersey, the same way my mother had spent hers a generation before me. I swam at a guarded beach between lifeguards, often carrying a boogie board to ride waves on my stomach, while the surfers one block north stood and flew free. I desperately wanted to join them, but Mom couldn't haul me down to the beach early for lessons without also hauling down three other kids. Then my parents split and sold the camper, and I took up long-distance running instead. When I came back to the shore as an adult, I watched a few group lessons from my beach chair, but all the kids I saw taking them were kids. My body had already accumulated the bulbs of aches and pains that would sprout to nagging as I slid through my 30s. I also traveled beyond the beach in the summer, taking long road trips to see this big, wide country with my dog and running shoes in tow. For a while, it felt more adventurous, even brave, than going to the same beach and eating in the same restaurants and getting ice cream cones from the same shops as I'd been doing most of the summers of my life. COVID put a pause on all that adventure. As the pandemic shut me up in my house in a Philadelphia suburb, my dad realized a dream of his own and bought a house in Avalon, blocks rather than miles from the beach. So when he asked me how I wanted to replace the blowout 40th birthday party I'd planned and then canceled, a surfboard popped out. I took a lesson where I was twice the age of the instructor and four times that of anyone else in the class. I never got close to getting on top of the board and on a wave at the same time, though my fellow students caught one on their second or third try. The afternoon after that first surf lesson, I napped for 2 hours, then went to bed at 9 p.m., only to wake before sunrise to screaming muscles that had never complained, even after running multiple 50K trail races. But I was hooked, even if I looked like a Bernese Mountain Dog in a lineup of whippets. When I should have been working, I watched surf videos, read articles about skill and technique, researched surf camps in San Diego, Costa Rica, Australia when it would open back up. In the fall and winter, I watched more experienced surfers in full wetsuits, hoods, boots, and gloves tackling the winter waves with a longing that I had both the gear and skills to do the same. I also read about others who turned to surfing later in life, like snowboarder Lindsay Jacobellis, who told Complex that it kind of puts your body in a different state. But even then, later in life, in surfing terms, was 19 years old, and she was coming from a balanced sport, and a professional at it, no less. As a non-professional ultra runner, my body can endure physical work and occasional pain, but being able to keep moving forward for very long periods of time was a whole different skill than navigating motion in three planes, or the balance required to ride even the most modest of Jersey Shore waves. I felt like I was learning to drive a stick shift car all over again with a slightly lower risk of dying. For 2 summers, I kept hammering away. I got better at paddling and judging and lining up with waves at their inflection points. I did not get better at popping up onto the board, but the near misses of standing up just as the water curled down were addictive with possibility. Even on bad surf days when the water was froth or glass, I'd still paddle out, hang off the board with the water hugging my torso and legs, and let myself drift. I'd stay that way until I got too close to the same guarded beach I'd swum at when I was a kid, then paddle back out to the surface section of the ocean that was, on those chopped or flat days, just for me, until I got too close again and went back to the start. At the very end of last summer, my second surfing summer, when the lifeguard stands emptied out as classrooms tentatively filled, I took the board out one last time. I saw a candidate wave, turned myself and my board and paddled. I caught the wave's tip and leaped up on the board at just the right time, but my balance faltered and instead of gliding with the wave, I came skidding on the shore, the force yanking my hair from its braid and filling my rash guard with sand. I landed in front of an older man with a perfect tan holding a surfboard, looking like he'd been doing this all his life, which he probably had. "Your crash wave bang," he said. "I'm what?" I yelled through a curtain of hair. "Your crash wave bang," he tried again. At first I thought he said afraid, or maybe it was brave. He said both, I've decided. This third surfing summer, I have changed again into glorious salty battle. I spent the winter doing push-ups and shoulder presses to help my body pop up easier. On my first time out on Memorial Day weekend, on a choppy sea that brought out a dozen surfers to my small surf beach, I strode into the water with my head held high, even if I was the only woman out, even when water knocked me back down over and over and over again. I was at least in the fight. Right before I turned back to shore, I saw a young girl coming out, probably the same age I was when I first longed to be in the water. She looked surprised to see me. Hello, she said, one hand guiding her pink board and the other waving at me. Hello, I called, then got hit in the back of the head by a wave, which pulled my board to the shore, my body attached to it and lurching after. I continued back in, and she surfed on, gliding the waves with ease. Maybe I'll get to her level one day. Even if I don't, I want to still be in the water, shouting back, hello. Our next article by Brittany Leitner is titled, What Does Non-Binary Mean? Everything You Need to Know About the Non-Binary Gender. You may have heard a few new terms floating around to describe gender or sexuality that you're unfamiliar with, and that's totally okay. As our understanding of sexuality and gender definition expands, so too does our vocabulary that describes these individuals. Instead of getting frustrated that you're out of the loop or don't totally understand every new term right away, consider this. The world isn't suddenly different, but our understanding of it continues to broaden, which can only be a good thing. If you've heard the term non-binary and wondered what it means, you're not alone. First, it helps to understand the term binary, meaning a coupling of two different things. If you're thinking about this in terms of the historical classification of gender, the gender binary includes male and female. When you use the term non-binary, you are asserting that there are more than two definitions of a single thing, in this case, gender. Therefore, gender non-binary means that an individual does not fit into the traditional binary categories of male and female. What is non-binary? Non-binary means existing or identifying outside the sex gender binary, neither man nor woman, or being partially or a combination of these things, explains Lee Phillips, psychotherapist and certified sex and couples counselor. Being non-binary is an umbrella term for a gender identity. Gender identity is an identifier someone uses to communicate how they understand their personal gender, navigate within or outside our societal gender systems, and or desire to be perceived by others, adds Phillips. Chelsea Reed, PhD, mental health counselor and author of Sexpert, Desire, Passion, Sensations, Intimacy, and Orgasm to Indulge in Your Best Sex Life, says it's helpful to think in simple terms for understanding non-binary. Gender is the mind and sex is the body, explains Reed. Gender identity is a social construct of what we think is masculine or feminine and where we think we fit in those categories. Gender identity does not have to be connected to our bodies. It is more about how we feel we fit into our community and society as a whole. What is gender identity? Someone's gender identity does not necessarily have to relate to the gender social constructs that are currently mainstream in a certain country or city where the individual lives. A person's gender identity is how they see and define themselves, regardless of how the outside world perceives them. A person chooses to define their gender identity and can therefore ask for different pronouns to be used by others to refer to them that feel more in line with their gender identity truth. Gender, including non-binary, is expressed individually, says Reed. Identifying as non-binary is different from identifying as transgender. Transgender is when somebody has a different identity than the body parts they have, says Reed. Most people still use the term after having their insides and outsides match, and others feel that transgender is describing not only the dissonance, but also the experience of their gender formation and transformation. Non-binary individuals may have any genitalia, but feel they do not fit into a masculine or feminine gender identity, says Reed. If there were a scale of masculinity, black, to femininity, white, then non-binary is all the shades of gray. These people may alter their appearance to match how they envision themselves, but not to be more feminine or masculine. It is to be more themselves. Different types of non-binary genders. As we continue to learn and expand our definition of genders and gender identity, the term non-binary does, for the time being, serve as a catch-all for an individual who does not identify with male or female genders. But within the non-binary term come different types of gender identities. Here are a few further breakdowns of non-binary as told by Phillips. Bigender refers to someone who has and/or experiences two genders. These genders can be binary or non-binary, and the person can experience both genders at the same time or may alternate between them. The experience of the two genders does not have to be equal for the individual. Trigender refers to someone who has and or experiences three genders. Multigender or polygender refers to someone who has and or experiences multiple gender identities. Demigender refers to someone who has or experiences a partial connection to gender or genders in question. Example usages: demiguy, demiboy, demigirl, dominion binary, demifluid, or demigender. Gender fluid refers to an individual who moves between genders. Their gender is not something they can pin down and define. And there are many more. How to use and understand pronouns. If you're ever unsure of an individual's pronouns, the best thing to do is politely ask, says Phillips. Non-binary people may use they as a subject pronoun, them, object pronoun, and theirs, possessive pronoun. There are many reasons why a non-binary person may use they pronouns. One reason is that they don't imply any information about a person's gender. A great way to ask about someone's preferred pronouns is to share yours first. You can simply say, "I'm Brittany. My pronouns are she, her. What about you?" It is okay if you slip up and use the incorrect pronoun, says Phillips. Just apologize and move on. I would not recommend profusely apologizing or asking the person to explain their pronouns in further detail. This may trigger anxiety and their gender dysphoria, distress, or unhappiness experienced because one's gender does not match their sex and/or gender assigned at birth. Our next article by Cynthia Dewi Oka is titled Far From the Sun. Exploring new ideas of what it means to be a good mother eases this writer into a life that doesn't orbit around her child anymore. A brown-skinned woman with close-cut hair is standing in a metal room facing a metal door. Millions of miles away from Earth, this door is all that separates her from lightless, airless space. Her teenage son watches her through a glass pane from the adjoining hallway. The woman's mind is made up. She injects blood oxygenator into her thigh and pushes a button. The door slides open. Barefaced and suitless, she shoots out of the ship like an arrow through the vacuum between stars. The best of science fiction creates enough distance between a speculative reality and our own to allow for escapism. Yet speculation only works when it holds enough recognizable elements for us to see ourselves, to feel invested in the decisions and outcomes of imaginary characters. Naomi Nagata, the soaring woman, is one of the main protagonists in the critically acclaimed science fiction series The Expanse, which completed its six-season run as an Amazon original in early 2022. Naomi is a bad mother, even by the feminist-friendly metrics of the 21st century. We have, in fact, changed very little, if any, of what is demanded of mothers. To function as unpaid primary caregivers for our children, to sacrifice our own needs for our families while expecting little to no reciprocity. We have added to this baseline the expectation that mothers also self-realize through our careers. What troubles me about Naomi's choice to leave her son and deploy through space on a mission of her own is that I know I would have likely done the opposite. I would have betrayed myself, anyone, any value that got in the way of me being a good mom. My son was born 2 weeks after I graduated high school, 9 days before I turned 18, 6 months after my father passed away, and 7 years after my family migrated from Indonesia. Both my parents were low-wage factory workers, my mother in electronics, my father in textiles. Not long after my son's first birthday, his biological father vanished from our lives. We have never received a single birthday card, phone call, or cent of child support. For many years, we were on our own until I fell in love and married my son's chosen father. That second marriage, that surrogate parent, gave me no reprieve from the sense of crushing responsibility and real economic precarity that drove me to constantly work multiple jobs at a time. Maman and her poverty, laments philosopher Roland Barthes in Morning Diary. Her struggle, her misfortune, her courage, a kind of epic without the heroic attitude. Insert eye roll. The idea that it is admirable for mothers to perform heroic tasks without the slightest entitlement to glory or even gratitude benefits literally everyone but mothers. Against the grind, I tried to preserve a couple of hours every day to write, usually before dawn. To give myself reasons to live, as Nigerian novelist Ben Okri put it, I never thought about it as a career until I was awarded the Amy Clampett residency, which paid me to live and write in a house in the Berkshires for a year. I began my residency 2 days after dropping my son off at college, resolved to be free. I had waited such a long time to focus on work for my own gratification rather than from obligation. I put each item on my long list of projects to accomplish on a post-it. I covered the walls with my intentions and filled up my Google Calendar. Each hour had to be accounted for. I wasn't really leaving behind my son. He was inevitably and rightfully entering adulthood. We communicated often by text and phone, and I continued to freelance heavily through the residency to cover his tuition. Yet the desolation of Naomi's leap into space, her lack of protection as she strove to close the gap between two ships moving farther and farther apart, I recognize this trial as my own. As it turns out, space is terrifying. My own adulthood had always had a short horizon, the first of the month when rent is due. My whole life had been organized around hours set by employers, deadlines set by institutions, schedules set by my son's extracurricular activities, chores and duties set by my family's needs, minimum payments set by creditors, and so on. As the months in residency progressed, these familiar limits grew distorted, like the lines of a net sinking below the surface of water. It wasn't that I felt less pressure to produce, it was that I suddenly had to exercise a muscle that had atrophied from underuse, that of making choices for myself. Surrounded by space, I realized that I did not know who I was at all, much less what I wanted, apart from others' expectations of me. As the eldest daughter of a devoutly Christian Indonesian family, I had been raised to be the object of my parents' pride. I had to be smart, but not have independent thoughts. Artistic, but never original. Beautiful, but never enticing. Articulate, but not around men. No was not permitted to be part of my vocabulary. My parents expected me to become fluent in English, achieve straight A's, and help them find work within months of arriving in Canada, though I had no access to an ESL program, and speaking English at home was considered a sign of disrespect. I managed to pull it off by reading entire sections of the school library with the help of a dictionary, then writing short stories to figure out, by trial and error, the rules of English grammar. Then I taught myself from templates to write resumes for my parents and help them role-play for interviews. My father specifically had trouble finding employment for years. While my mother was at work, he took care of my little sister and me. He packed our lunches, cooked our dinners, did the laundry. He also, however, constantly criticized and berated us for everything from a grass stain on our jeans to needing corrective eyeglasses. His rage was larger than life. Unable to reconcile his faith in God with his sense of failure, he reasoned that the only possible explanation for our prolonged economic misery was my hidden sins. He took to searching my room, reading my diary, listening in on my phone calls with friends, and stalking me while I made my way to the town library after school. I became hypervigilant, depressed, and reckless with my life. By the time I was 16, I was flunking my classes, getting in fights, consuming any alcohol and drugs I could get my hands on, and sneaking out every night into my boyfriend's car, the only place where I could sometimes fall asleep. I did not plan it, but having my own child became the only way I could imagine experiencing love in my life. I felt abandoned by my mother because I never saw her try to protect me from my father's abuse. I was determined to raise my son on my own after his biological father left us, despite the grim statistics. Relentless judgment doled out by friends, relatives, colleagues, and even strangers, teen mom stigma perpetuated by popular culture, and indescribable pain at becoming the object of not pride but shame for my family. I sacrificed my personhood to end what I saw as a cycle of abandonment. From the outside, mothers can seem dignified, in her place, with an absolute kindness for everyone, to quote Barthes again. I too have been guilty of idealizing my mother in such a way that she is simultaneously diminished, of mistaking who she has had to be for who she is. It will take collective effort to shift our view of mothering from a woman's destiny to skilled and highly specialized labor that requires lifetime commitment and therefore systemic support. That includes the right to reproductive health care that allows us to decide for ourselves, with our own best interest in mind, whether we want to mother. One by one, I took down the post-its all over the residency house that told me what I should be doing to self-realize as a writer. I focused on completing two projects that were already underway and taught myself instead the things I never had a chance to learn during 19 years of mothering. How to buy groceries for one, which type of exercise helped me best manage chronic pain caused by chronic overwork, what it means to let myself experience fear, doubt, loneliness, and grief, feelings I have had to mute to keep functioning. It is a grueling, repetitive process. I have to work a part of myself each time that has not been allowed to breathe, risking despair each time I go in to access the wounds that have become my own looped distress call. You are a mistake that cannot be fixed. You are worthless. You will never be loved. Some part of me may always be enthralled to these words. They give me permission to be an extra in my own life, to avoid reaching for a reality that I do not just survive, but choose and desire. Someday, maybe, while watching the night descend, I will think of the mother who flew alone through the unforgiving silence between stars and hear me say to myself, in my own voice, you are loved. Our next article by Philip Dre is titled, Remembering and Speaking Frightful Wrongs. Nations reel and stagger on their way. They make hideous mistakes. They commit frightful wrongs. They do great and beautiful things, wrote W.E.B. Du Bois. And shall we not best guide humanity by telling the truth about all of this, so far as the truth is ascertainable? By Du Bois's logic, memorializing the 1892 lynching of a black resident of Port Jervis, New York, even 130 years later, would serve to guide humanity. A worthy effort. But on June 2nd, at the public unveiling of a plaque recognizing Robert Lewis and his murder, the questions left unanswered were, did we wait too long? Do heartfelt words even matter? Even a full month earlier, 10 black citizens of Buffalo, New York, had been shot to death at a supermarket by a white supremacist. Drawing attention to the same insidious truce of 1892, that in the United States, racialized violence isn't regional. Today is the end of the 19th century. The country is in a perilous place where democratic norms are abused and abandoned, lies are rife, and determined forces would do away with the teaching of history and the remembering of frightful wrongs. On June 2, 1892, Robert Lewis, 28, who drove a horse-drawn bus for a local hotel, was accused of sexually assaulting a young white woman named Lena McMahon as she sat reading a book by the riverside. Presumed guilty and denied due process of law, he was seized by a white mob and dragged up Sussex Hill to East Main Street, where despite the brave efforts of a policeman, the village president, and a judge to intervene, he was hanged from a tree before a crowd of 2,000 people, about one-fifth of the local population. The incident was infamous at once, for it was perceived as important that the lynching of black Americans, a horror then epidemic in the South, would extend its tendrils northward. Southern methods outdone, blared a headline. There had been a sharp uptick in these crimes. 74 in 1885, 94 in 1889, 113 in 1891. The year of the Port Jervis lynching, 1892, would see the greatest number, 161, almost one every other day. This growing frequency of deadly assaults on black people was compounded in March 1891 by the mass lynching in New Orleans of 11 Italian-Americans suspected of complicity in the murder of the police chief. Anyone, regardless of race or ethnicity, it showed, could fall victim to a mob. It was in response to this crisis that in late spring 1892, at about the time of Robert Lewis's death, the first national anti-lynching advocacy appeared in the writing of journalist Ida B. Wells and the legendary Frederick Douglass, and in a published resolution denouncing lynching signed by prominent civil rights activists and endorsed by New York Governor Roswell P. Flower and President Benjamin Harrison. But what perplexed people up and down the Hudson Valley was why a lynching had occurred in Port Jervis, a prosperous community with a modest black population of about 200 men, women, and children. And while the village was not free of the typical racial bias and inequities of the day, whites had in past years voted down a bid for local black suffrage and forced black people to move from a nearby reservoir out of concern they were contaminating the town's drinking water, it had no flagrant history of anti-black violence. News of the Lewis lynching ran for weeks in regional and national papers as local courts struggled, without success, to hold the mob's ringleaders accountable. The white people of Port Jervis were not of one mind about what had occurred. There was shame at the barbarity of the lynching, one local paper conceding. We never imagined such crimes could be enacted in this beautiful valley. We mourn like a stricken household, which was matched by regret for the damage to the town's reputation. And while many disavowed the blatant illegality of the act, some thought Lewis deserved his fate. There appears to have been little, if any, outreach from white citizens to the traumatized black community to apologize or make amends, and over the ensuing 130 years, Port Jervis came to observe a tacit silence about the matter, a hush that deepened as the community, at the confluence of the Delaware and Neversink rivers, encountered social and economic setbacks, including the depletion of its once thriving manufacturing sector and importance as a regional rail hub. The June 2, 2022 commemoration of the event strove to bring Robert Lewis's life as well as his death to the town's attention. "There is no hero in this story," observes Ralph Drake, one of the founders of the Friends of Robert Lewis, the group that supported the unveiling and the remembrance march that traced the route of the lynch mob. "The town must become the hero in confronting its legacy." Port Jervis has now undertaken that important work thanks to the Friends group and, more broadly, the influence of the New York Times 1619 Project, the work of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, which promotes a national focus on and dialogue about America's history of racial injustice and its legacy, and the global impact of the Black Lives Matter movement. 3 weeks after George Floyd's murder in May 2020, local activist Arabia Shearn organized a dramatic biracial march through Port Jervis, past the site of the Lewis lynching and concluding in a large rally at historic Orange Square. This year, there was a different kind of silence on June 2nd, no longer of neglect and avoidance, but born of mourning and commitment to educate future generations about what had occurred. There was hope that the town's public acknowledgement of a past wrong, represented by remarks from Mayor Kelly Decker and other dignitaries, may enable an increased recognition of local Black heritage and further engagement between all residents. As one speaker assured the crowd, all the hate and rage that surrounded Robert Lewis on that tragic afternoon in 1892 was conquered by the overwhelming message of love at this gathering 13 decades later. The unveiling of the plaque for Robert Lewis and the uplifting speeches and songs that accompanied it are essential to a community beginning a journey of healing and repair. But even as the town of Port Jervis came together to memorialize its painful history, residents and visitors are still mourning the deadly racist killing just a five-hour drive away in Buffalo. As a historian, I believe we must rise to the challenge of our present by truly knowing our nation's difficult history. The mistreatment of Black people in the late 19th century, of which lynching was only the most heinous manifestation, resulted from white fear. A fear of change, fear of the future, and of Black advances made possible by Reconstruction and competition over jobs, a Black enfranchisement, and the rise of elected and appointed men of color. This anxiety was expressed in white-authored theories of pseudoscientific race science and insulting caricatures in daily newspapers, voter suppression, and in the white presumption of Black criminality and the related assumption of police powers by white vigilantes, often with the collusion of actual police. Elemental to this dread was guilt among white men for their own centuries-long predation of Black women, which led them to place white women on a pedestal of sexual purity and to then criminalize and insist on the ultimate penalty for any perceived sexual transgression, relationship, or even passing flirtation between a Black man and a white woman. At the same time, white male dominance and patriarchy in society were sharply threatened as a generation of young white women left the family farm to work in mills, move to cities, and gain independence. Today, we are watching violence result from a somewhat familiar eddy of change and continuity. Where the Ku Klux Klan organized its white insecurity in the 19th century, we face not dissimilar anti-democratic forces. Our own age is one of amplified white grievance and anxiety over an anticipated great replacement, the growing role of women and people of color in society, a transformation in the ways people choose to identify by gender or sexual orientation, and even how children learn about our nation's history. And as Buffalo and Uvalde remind us, today's obscene frequency of mass shootings, which occur, as lynchings once did, almost every other day, continues the historic connection between gun violence and white supremacy. guns in the hands of whites and forced human enslavement, the fugitive slave laws, the black codes of Reconstruction, and Jim Crow segregation, and enabled a world of vigilantism in which, as Du Bois noted, all black men were presumed to be criminals and all white men were the police. Today's owners of AR-15 seem at times to cling defiantly to their military-style weapons as a kind of symbolic last redoubt against unwanted change. Given these deep-seated structural faults, what difference can people of goodwill, of diverse ages and colors, marching together to honor the victim of a century-old lynching and vowing to educate the present community and future generations possibly make? The answer, I believe, is everything. We'll end this week with some quotes about autumn. The heat of autumn is different from the heat of summer. One ripens apples, the other turns them to cider. Jane Hirschfield wrote in her poem, The Heat of Autumn. I'm so glad I live in a world where there are Octobers. L.M. Montgomery from her novel, Anne of Green Gables. I would rather sit on a pumpkin and have it all to myself than be crowded on a velvet cushion. Henry David Thoreau wrote in his book, Walden. Autumn burned brightly, a running flame through the mountains, a torch flung to the trees. Faith Baldwin in her novel, American Family. Autumn is springtime in reverse. Terry Guillemets in her poem, Falling Up. I would rather sit on a pumpkin and have it all to myself than be crowded on a velvet cushion. Henry David Thoreau wrote in his book, Walden. Autumn burned brightly, a running flame through the mountains, a torch flung to the trees. Faith Baldwin in her novel, American Family. Autumn is springtime in reverse. Terry Guillemets in her poem, Falling Up. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.